Hello and welcome to the second episode of the Totally Football Show presents Zonal Marking. This is a six-part summer series to coincide with the release of Zonal Marking, The Making of Modern European Football, a book written by our very own Michael Cox. Hello, Coxie.
Hello, Ian.
Just in case you didn't hear last week's episode about the Ajax side of 1995 and you're completely confused about what's going on, tell us about the book, Michael.
It's a book about the history of modern European football, taking into account the seven major footballing nations, looking at each of them in turn, a period of dominance where they're particularly strong. And yeah, today we're looking at Serie A in the late 1990s, which I think was probably the strongest league at this point of any that I look at in the book.
And today we're looking at Juventus, their period of dominance in the mid to late 1990s. And so the natural choice as our second panellist was James Horncastle.
Hello, Ian.
Michael, only one European Cup victory for Juventus during this period, and that was on penalties against Ajax. So why on earth are we talking about them?
Because I think they were just very, very feared at the time. They weren't revered in the way that, say, Van Gaal's Ajax or Cruyff's Barcelona or later Guardiola's Barcelona were, but they were the team you just didn't want to get drawn against. It wasn't heroic to lose to Juventus in the same way it was if you lose to a bit of Messi magic or something. It was they will grind you down, they will nullify your best players, and more often than not, they would get past you, especially in two-legged games. In the finals, they didn't really perform to their capabilities, but they were very feared.
I came of age watching this team. I lost my innocence too, I would say.
Where did you watch it?
I said innocence, not virginity.
Oh, right. Yeah. The two go together.
But I think if as a kid kind of growing up in England at the time, you know, the best team here was Manchester United. And I found it really quite interesting that if you read Ferguson's book or the diaries that he kind of published at the time, he doesn't really seem to be all that influenced by the great Van Gaal Ajax team. The benchmark for him and that those United players was Juventus, partly because they always came up against them in the group stages or in the knockout stages of the Champions League, and invariably, with the exception of 99, would get knocked out or get beat by them. And for me, still one of my favourite YouTube clips is when Gary Neville is being interviewed on ITV and he finds out that Juventus are through, and he reacts as though it's the worst thing that has ever happened to him.
Juventus qualified.
Yeah, Juventus qualified.
Let's have a look at that team. Could we go through and name a starting 11 of a Juventus team of that era and sort of a quick chat about how they played? Who was in goal?
Angelo Peruzzi.
Okay. Are we talking a back four here?
Usually, they're very flexible, but you usually had Pesotto and Torricelli were the two most regular fullbacks. In defence, you had Ciro Ferrara and, of course, Paolo Montero, who was, you know, the centre-back you didn't want to play against. I think Ronaldo said he was the best defender he ever played against, just physically very intimidating.
I thought he would have said Mark Juliano, but we'll get to that later.
In midfield, what kind of shape are we looking at?
Didier Deschamps was the holding player. He was supported by a lot of foot soldiers, the likes of Di Livio and Antonio Conte, of course.
And we got any pace out wide?
Not so much. Narrow team depended increasingly on Zinedine Zidane as the number 10.
Oh, yes, we'll definitely talk about him later. And up front?
Well, I mean, this is the remarkable thing about Juventus at that time, and I think one of the things that defines them as a club still to this day is just how changeable it was. Because, yes, I think if you look at this team, you associate it with Gianluca Vialli, Fabrizio Ravanelli and Alessandro Del Piero. But in each of their runs to the final, the centre forward changed. You know, from one year, it would go from Vialli to Vieri, Vieri to Inzaghi, and they seemed to be able to cope with losing one of their best players every year, re-ing up and going again. And that's, I think, still to this day, something that defines Juve.
And then, of course, the manager, Marcello Lippi. When I close my eyes, I see him, 2006, World Cup, big cigar, looking very happy. But this is, weirdly, like his crowning glory.
It's very interesting looking at this era in Italian football because it is defined by two managers, Fabio Capello and Marcello Lippi. And Capello was, let's say, a more cosmopolitan manager in that he didn't just win with one club. He didn't just win in one country. He could go anywhere and win. Whereas Lippi most, if not all, of his success in club terms is with Juventus over two spells. And I always felt there was a touch of glamour about Lippi and Juventus at the time. I always remember seeing the players kind of, you know, be substituted in winter, kind of steam coming off their bodies, and then being kind of put into these kind of fur-lined tracksuit coats, which I always thought was like, wow, that is insane. And then you would see Lippi with a Monte Cristo cigar on the bench sort of already then, with his kind of silver fox-like hair. There was a real kind of, I'd say, flair to that Juve setup. There were some flair players in the teams over the years, but I wouldn't say you'd necessarily associate them with playing scintillating, exciting, good football.
Well, let's have a look at that. And Coxie, what would you say Lippi's philosophy is?
Well, in a sense, I don't think he had one compared to the sides that Juve superseded as the team to beat in Europe, the Barcelona and the Ajax sides. It was very flexible. It was very tactical. I think it was the kind of classic Italian, we'll try to shut down your best players and leave a couple of our star attackers to do what they want on the break. But this wasn't a team that really tried to impose themselves in terms of possession play. They changed formation from week to week. They could play three at the back, they could play four at the back. They had a lot of players who were very good at shutting down players more than anything else. So it was, in that respect, I think they were maybe the most classically Italian team of the 90s. They didn't have as much class as the Milan side, but they were very good at getting the job done.
How does Lippi inculcate that kind of that versatility? Is it just repetition on the training field and having players who are willing to work and follow instructions?
Yeah, and also a huge emphasis upon fitness sessions. I mean, at this point, you heard these horror stories about Juventus and their training sessions. And, you know, at a time when English sides were still, you know, going out boozing after training, it was a very different world. And that was, I think, quite notable in the contribution of some of the lesser players, you know, who weren't superstars, but in big games would always step up. And again, I think that's something that Manchester United took a lot of inspiration from. You know, Ferguson's best sides always had some versatile, you know, jack of all trades players who could do a job wherever. And that's what Juventus were all about.
And to return to Gary Neville for the second time, which is not something I expected to do, I think he writes about going out to the pub after training with Manchester United at the time and ordering 15 pints of lager and a glass of champagne for Eric. The Italians, of course, even in the 80s, when Graeme Souness and Trevor Francis are over there, they're reporting how fitness-focused everything is. But does Lippi genuinely like stand out even in that field?
Well, he had a fitness coach called Venterone, who is known as the Marine. he would drive the players very hard. I mean, inevitably, you'll have a lot of people cast aspersions on the fitness preparation of Juventus in that time because of subsequent investigations. But in terms of how hard these players worked and what the setup was at Juventus, they put a lot of emphasis on weights. Roberto Baggio, for example, who, well, the end of his Juventus career is the beginning of Marcello Lippi's, really. And he is someone who always believes in natural talent. Isn't someone I would say who would necessarily be, you know, there in the weights room doing his bench presses and trying to beat his record like that. But all of a sudden, one summer, all these new machines turn up in the Juventus gym, and you have all these, as Michael was saying, horror stories insofar as, yeah, just the kind of, you can imagine your worst PE teacher in terms of just running you into the ground and, you know, there being a bell to ring if you want to give up. It's that kind of mentality.
Oh, no.
And that's why, again, other people have different ideas on this, but there was a sense that that Juventus team would run you into the ground. They would run all over you. And I think that's maybe something that elevated them a little bit in this era as well.
This, of course, reminds me of a former Chelsea manager, Antonio Conte, who's one of the foot soldiers we mentioned earlier. It seems like he's followed that sort of line. Has he ever sort of spoken about Lippi and the influence that he had from him?
Well, I think Michael's spot on when he says that Lippi does not have a defining philosophy, but he does have a set of kind of core principles, a lot of which are centered around the kind of team, the kind of spirit that you can develop in gender, and how important getting the right characters into a team is. And I think that's one of the things that's really interesting about this era at Juventus is there are Zidanes, there are Del Pieros, but there are players that Lippi kind of would bring with him from Atalanta or Napoli, like Tacchinardi, like Montero, like Fabio Pecchia. You know, all these kind of players who are not particularly glamorous names, but he knew he could trust, rely on, and wouldn't rock the boat. And whenever you hear Antonio Conte talk about his philosophy, if he's got one, is that tactically, probably learnt the most from Arrigo Sacchi when he was in the national team, and he was a coach who we'd look to and try and study and learn from. But in terms of forming a team, it's always like, I don't care how talented you are, if you're not the right kind of character, I don't want you in the team. And I think that very much comes from Lippi.
Yes, we saw a bit of that with Diego Costa. With Conte, Michael, you talk about him as typifying the spirit of the side. What kind of player was Conte? We know him now for, you know, luxuriant hair.
Which he lost whilst he was playing for Juventus.
Yeah, because it was a strange thing that he ended up with, wasn't it? It was just a kind of very, very thin emo fringe and then nothing for yards and yards and yards rolling back down his head. But that's not really the question. The question was, what kind of player was he, and was he typical of that Juventus side?
Yeah, more than anything, I think he was a leader and he was very, very hardworking. That's not to say he didn't have technical quality. I remember him scoring a fantastic bicycle kick a little bit later in his Juve career. But when I think of this Juventus, I think of players like him, of Torricelli, Di Livio, Gianluca Pesotto, who you don't really know what their best position is. They can play right back, left back, defensive midfield. They can man mark someone. And there was a nice example of that I found in the 96 Champions League final where they overcome Ajax on penalties, where it's towards the end of the game and Torricelli at right back has got cramp and is really struggling against one of Ajax's wingers. And Lippi's solution is he just switches his fullbacks. Torricelli and Pesotto just go and play on opposite sides. And I think that kind of typifies what Juventus and what Italian players are all about. You can't imagine an English side doing that, or a Spanish side or a Dutch side, but they weren't, you know, out of position. They were just in another of the positions they could play. And that's the kind of thing that won Juventus so many games, and maybe not even won games, but prevented the opposition from winning, because they were just so good at nullifying opponents and marking them and shutting them down.
They weren't too bad at scoring goals either, were they?
Yeah, lots of options up front. I mean, versatile, hardworking players. Viali was the ultimate example. You look at his scoring record throughout his career, it's not spectacular, but again, really fit, really tactically disciplined. And I must say, him and Ravinelli, their combination play was absolutely exceptional.
That's Ravinelli's cross. Oh, Viali! What a strike by Gianluca Viali. That's his hat-trick.
Viali's background, James, not exactly typical for a footballer, is it?
No, I mean, it's great. I mean, he's from Cremona, and if you look at where he grew up, the house he grew up in, I think he can get married there these days, because it's one of those spectacular kind of villas. And I think when Juventus won the Champions League, or at least when they won the league in this era, one time they did have the title celebration party in the Viali, what was the Viali family home, which was a kind of, if you want to imagine, it's like going to Downton Abbey. So, I mean, he arrived at Juve, I suppose, quite late, 28. He'd been a big part of that Samp side with Roberto Mancini, come very close to winning the Champions League in, what, 92, going out to the to that total footballing Cruyff side, Barcelona. But I'd say he was maybe one of the glamour names in that team, because we all think of Ravinelli as being one of the kind of exotic foreign names of the early Premier League years. But the reality is this the guy, he like goes to, and this was so typical of Juve at the time, they plucked him from like the second division.
Is he basically Reggiana, the Italian Guy Whittingham?
I think that's a disservice to Fabrizio. I mean, to be fair, I also love Ravinelli, because I always think he had one of the great nicknames, certainly for me growing up and watching Italian football, which is the White Feather.
Oh, yeah.
And again, just one of the most iconic players of that era, with that kind of white buzz cut.
Well, it's basically
that he had
at the same time as George Clooney is doing so much good for prematurely greying men, and thanks for that, George. Ravinelli's doing it in Italy as well. It's like a power movement. All right, so the 1996 European Cup final, if you're listening last week with Tom Williams, we spoke about Ajax and that 95 team. They don't win this one, though, do they, Coxie?
No, Juventus win on penalties. You know, Dutch sides are probably the only worse sides than English sides in terms of winning penalty kicks. Juve should have wrapped this up in the first half. And you know, despite the fact they weren't necessarily an attractive free-flowing side, you look at this matchup in the final and you see Viali, Ravanelli and Del Piero constantly running in behind into space. And you think, actually, this was a really fearsome side. I think the thing that comes across in this game and also in the semi-final between the sides a year later is Juventus' superior fitness levels. And that wasn't something that Ajax were working on a lot at this time. They were about shape, about technical quality. In terms of their gym exercises, it would be about flexibility. But Juventus looked powerful. And I think, although they didn't win the game in 90 minutes or 120 minutes, that's the area where they're clearly superior.
And then after that game, James, Viali leaves, Ravanelli leaves, both heading to a cash-flush England. And in comes some lad called Zinedine Zidane, who turns out to be all right in the end, but not initially.
No, I mean, Zidane would ultimately leave because he didn't win the Champions League with Juventus, and that would be a big regret. And I suppose if you want to make comparisons with the present day, just as buying Cristiano Ronaldo isn't enough to win Juventus the Champions League, nor was winning Zinedine Zidane when it came to helping them retain that. But yeah, they signed him from Bordeaux. Luciano Moggi, the shall we say, slightly controversial general manager of Juventus in that time, tells a story about going to watch him playing for Bordeaux and noticing that his opposite number at Milan was in the stands. They thought that Milan were going to try and get Zinedine Zidane. Instead, they were very much relieved to find that they went for Christophe Dugarry instead. And, you know, we all know that Zinedine had a slightly better career than Dugarry. Dugarry still had a very good career, but compared with Zidane, I would say, you know, most people grew up wanting to be Zidane more than they did Dugarry.
But Zidane really changes the nature of this team, doesn't he, Michael?
Yeah, I was interested in his first couple of seasons at Juventus. And in fact, when I was researching for the book, I came across one of James's pieces about Zidane's first couple of years. And I didn't realise he played in such a deep role to start with. He was almost like the position we associate with Pirlo now. And gradually he gets more and more advanced. And basically Juventus's shape transforms. So they end up playing more than a 4-4-2. They're playing 4-3-1-2. And Zidane is behind the front two. And it's a slow start at Juventus, but by the end of that first season, there's that semi-final I mentioned against Ajax in a 4-1. And he plays the most remarkable game I've seen from him, maybe alongside Portugal in the Euro 2000 semi-final, where he's just running the game and orchestrating the game and providing an assist and providing a goal.
In cui può inserirsi, vediamo Zidane, Zidane, attenzione, dribble tutti quanti, un gol stupendo del francese e la Juventus passa sul 4-1, ancora una doppietta.
And it's clear by that point that Juventus have, to a certain extent, lucked out, because I think that he was always a talented player, but I'm not sure he was quite considered that he would lead Juventus to that extent, because Juventus aren't really a team of stars. They're a team of workers at this point, but Zidane kind of changes that.
And he's not even the most celebrated player in the team. And this is a line I feel I'll be repeating a lot, but some of our listeners will be a little younger and they won't have watched him firsthand. Tell me about Del Piero. What was he and how good was he?
Well, Del Piero is a big reason why I grew my hair long. him and Dave Grohl. unfortunately, I was never quite able to master the Dogtanian kind of sideburns and goatee that Del Piero rocked. But Del Piero, essentially, he joins Juventus in, what was it, 93 for just 2 million from Padova. And is so good. Convinces the club that, okay, we can actually move on from that guy who just won the Ballon d'Or, certain Roberto Baggio, which seemed like a big risk at the time. But you see already in that first season that Lippi has at Juventus, the impact he had, particularly probably the most famous goal, one of the most famous and iconic goals of that era, which came against Fiorentina when Juventus were 2-0 down at home at the Delle Alpi. And they come back, and then just before the end, there's this long, hopeful ball into the box, and Del Piero watches it over his shoulder and side foot volleys it to win the game.
Del Piero has made the run! Oh, what a goal for Del Piero! That's a beauty!
And really, from that point on, Del Piero, I think, entered the hearts of the Juventus faithful. But they had Zidane, who would win the Ballon d'Or, who would become the most iconic player of a generation. For Italians, he was, for Juventus in particular, the most enduring and most popular player on that side was definitely Del Piero.
Well, he kept going for some time, didn't he?
He did, yeah. He was ultimately forced out by Andrea Agnelli. But yeah, I mean, he was seen as a bandiera, which is a standard bearer, the flag bearer, one club man, even though he played for Padova. But someone who really seemed to incarnate everything about lo stile Juve, the Juventus style, I suppose, if you want to translate that in English, it would be like the West Ham way. Juventus have always had this tradition of great number 10s. It's one of the great football shirts that there is out there. You think of Omar Sivori, you think of Michel Platini, in particular Baggio, Del Piero, and he very much honoured that. And I would say a lot of Juventus fans, even a Juventus club historian, would say he was probably top three player in the club's history.
And by the end of this season, which is the 96-97 season, Cox, he's absolutely flying. There's another victory over Ajax, this time in the semi-finals of the Champions League, and it's a little more convincing this time, isn't it?
Yeah, as I mentioned before, Zidane was incredible, and that's, I think, the moment where Juventus really confirmed that they're the side to beat in Europe. You know, winning on penalties in the final of the previous season, it's considered something of a, you know, a fortunate victory on penalties, but by this point, they were really, really strong favourites going into that final against Dortmund, who were big outsiders.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you've got this star-studded Juve team, James, and then you've got Borussia Dortmund with Paul Lambert in the midfield. I mean, it's only going to go one way, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is a Dortmund side that Juventus had beaten earlier in the 90s when, you know, winning the UEFA Cup in, I think, the group the year before as well. And as much as Luciano Moggi, if you can praise Luciano Moggi for the teams that he built at that time, one of his big mistakes was seen as that of selling Paulo Sousa. QPR, Swansea and Leicester fans might not think that was an error of judgment, although I'm a big fan of Sousa, the manager. But if you ever have that pub quiz and you're asked to name how many players have won the Champions League in back-to-back years with different clubs, Paulo Sousa is one of them. And it was a big shock that Juventus lost that. They thought they were going to become the first side to retain the Champions League in the Champions League era. And there's a great goal. Juventus goal, one of the great forgotten final goals in that game, the Del Piero kind of back heel. Certain Lars Ricken ends up shattering dreams. Football manager legend, Ian. Is that what you're going to say, Lars Ricken?
I wasn't, sort of mid-90s. I think about it, he was entirely decent.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Into space, the fresh legs of Ricken. The shot! Ricken scores!
You've got, generally speaking, two Paul Lambert stories. One is that Paul Lambert won the European Cup in this game, and the other that being a lifetime teetotaler and being told that when you come up against Sir Alex Ferguson, it's always good to have a nice bottle of wine if you want to have a chat with him. He bought a very, very expensive bottle of red wine, apparently, and he wanted everything to be right and perfect, so he invited Ferguson into his office, at which point he said, "I've got you a bottle of red wine," and pulled it out of the fridge.
Oh.
Yeah.
Some reds are okay chilled.
Well, actually, in Italy, it is a bit of a thing, isn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, it
maybe
very
that's
much
what he was going for.
Depend on the advice he's got. I mean, obviously, I don't get the impression that, you know, as a teetotaler, he was some kind of sommelier who knew his stuff.
Just nailed it first time.
It's a shame.
Anyway, once again, they regroup. Once again, it all changes up front. In comes Inzaghi. Tell me about him.
Super Pippo. well, he was coming, I think, from Atalanta, where he just had a season for the ages. They've been a great year in terms of the top scorer race in Italy between him and Vincenzo Montella, who'd really gone, you know, week by week. It was, you know, one has the nose in front of the other. And Inzaghi has held the single season scoring record at Atalanta ever since. Anyway, he moves, and we all know what Inzaghi's like. He's a poacher. Later when he goes to AC Milan, you know, you hear stories about games in training where some of the more talented superstars at Milan are just laughing at how bad he is in terms of a footballer. But when it comes to scoring goals and finishing and being in the right place at the right time and knowing where the ball's going to fall, probably nobody better in history than Pippo Inzaghi.
The thing is, Coxie, being in the right place at the right time, which he so often was, how could he not pick up the offside rule in all those years of football?
Yeah, I mean, I guess because this Juve side was perfect for him because They had Zidane and they had Del Piero. In another side, Del Piero could be considered almost the number 10. Of course, he wore number 10. But with Zidane playing that number 10 role, you've got two players who are there to provide the creativity. So Inzaghi didn't have to do any coming short, linking play, dropping deep. He can just focus on scoring goals. And there's this fantastic relationship between Del Piero and Inzaghi. When I say fantastic, I mean on the pitch, sometimes they combine beautifully. But, you know, gradually fell out in part because Inzaghi's just so selfish. And there's a fantastic game away at Venezia where Inzaghi scores a hat-trick. All three goals he could and probably should have passed to Del Piero. And this is a point where Del Piero is actually on a really barren run and hasn't scored for about 7 months. And Inzaghi's away celebrating in front of the fans on his own. And Del Piero's just hanging his head in the middle, walking back to the centre circle.
Bless him. And then Juve win another league title in 97-98, but not before an infamous incident in their crucial clash against title rivals Inter.
Inter were denied a penalty, then moments later, referee Ceccarini awarded Juventus one.
Una cosa scandalosa.
One politician described yesterday's events as scandalous. The press labelled the championship shameful.
James, talk us through exactly what happened here, because it had repercussions that echoed for some time, didn't it?
Yeah, I would say this is one of the most controversial and bitterest moments in Italian football history, in that you have this very close title race between Juventus and Inter. This game takes place at the end of April. It's seen as a title decider. Ronaldo, or Phenomeno, is dribbling into the penalty area and kind of gets stopped by this brick wall that is Marculiano. And it looks like a stonewall penalty, but the referee does not blow his whistle. Instead, he waves to play on and Juventus go up the other end of the pitch. I think it's Del Piero goes over in the box. And what happens? They get a penalty. And it sparked incredible scenes. You can imagine the Inter players who already... There was already an air of suspicion around particularly Moggi and by the same token Juventus at that time. And this seemed to offer some sort of confirmation of that. Now, Del Piero, I think, missed that penalty, but Juventus still won the game 1-0. But this was very much seen as the season of veleno, poison, in terms of just how bad it got. And of course, when in 2006 you have the Calciopoli scandal, you have particularly Inter fans, but fans of other clubs as well, pointing at this era and saying, you know, what could have been, you know, were the things that were uncovered between 2004 and 2006 going on all the way back in the late 90s? And every time Inter play Juventus, that referee always gets a phone call. Say, do you still stand by that decision? And more or less, he always does.
And this is why Juventus are generally regarded as everyone in Italy's second favourite team.
Well, it's interesting because in Italy, Juventus are the best supported club. They're on the one hand known as the fidanzata d'Italia, Italy's girlfriend, but they're also the most hated team in Italy, and are known as Rubentus, which comes from the verb rubare, which means to steal. There you have this kind of conflict there between people who love Juventus and people who hate Juventus.
And there was something for the people who hate Juventus in that third straight European Cup final, in which they get a second straight defeat. And this time it's at the hands of Real Madrid. And it feels like the end of an era, Michael.
Yeah, so in this game, Juve really don't turn up and Real are superior without even really playing well themselves. Winner scored by Predrag Mijatovic, who of course later went to Fiorentina, great rivals of Juventus.
Roberto Carlos Mijatovic! Goal! Ha marcado el Madrid! Ha marcado Mijatovic, minuto 21 de la segunda partida!
And now it's very obvious that the mood around Juve changes, in the sense that you go from the side who everyone thought was the most dominant in Europe to actually, why aren't they doing it in finals? You know, two defeats in a row. Again, the one before that, they only won on penalties when they probably should have won against Ajax in 96. And yeah, it starts to kind of unravel, and you do feel like, you know, the incredibly intense demands of Lippi is basically starting to drain the players, and you do notice a drop-off from a lot of the players. I don't think it helped as well that Zidane and Deschamps won the World Cup, because they came back really, really tired. And Zidane in particular had a very poor season. And, you know, the way they were playing 4-3-1-2 was Zidane theoretically linking midfield and attack. If he wasn't doing that, then Juventus looked suddenly like quite an average team.
How does it end for Lippi and Juve?
Well, Lippi ends up leaving, what, midway through the 98-99 season, which I think coincided with the semi-final with United, which is, of course, the Roy Keane game in the second leg in at the Stadio delle Alpi. But Lippi would come back for a second spell. And again, this is a theme that runs through Juventus' history, reaching another European Cup final 2003 and lose on penalties to AC Milan. And I suppose you could say this era, if you like, although that Juventus won one European Cup, they won the European Super Cup, beating PSG 9-2 on aggregate. And if you look at some of the goal scorers in that game, it's not the guys you were mentioning as the star-studded ones. It's Porini, it's Padovano, it's Ferrara, it's Lombardo, it's Amoroso. But Juventus were always competitive through that era. I mean, again, you look at 91 to 2003, Lippi wins five league titles, Capello wins five league titles. It's very much those two guys. And as we say, Lippi goes to Inter and it really doesn't work out for him. It's complete disaster, but he comes back to Juve and he restores them to success.
So we've rather carefully danced around one subject, which is Juventus, their relentless, tireless running and the way that they maintained those kind of levels and suspicion thereof.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of suspicion cast over that Juventus team in the 1990s, in part because of their association with Luciano Moggi, the general manager at the time. Moggi in 2006 would be brought down by the Calciopoli scandal, which revealed this network of influence when it came to designating referees. But the other thing is the doping investigation that went on also at the beginning of the 2000s. Because if you look at Zenit Zeman, who was one of the tactically more interesting managers of the early 90s in Italian football, he was very outspoken. He was seen as an outsider because he was Czech. He wasn't part of the establishment. And he said that Italian football needs to get out of the pharmacy. And he made some very severe accusations against, not just against Juventus. I think what was interesting was that he alluded to the transformation of some Juventus players. And you look at that time, how I think some clubs, not just Juventus, were looking to explore how far you could go in terms of the use of new supplements, many of which were illegal. But the investigation happens. You have an outcome which I think wasn't really satisfying to anyone, really. I think Juventus felt that some of the players, in terms of the cross-examination, it was a little bit ludicrous in terms of them being asked, Ian, what were you doing at 10 a.m. on August 13th, 1996? Do you remember how much water you drank? Do you remember all this sort of thing? And of course, a lot of the players couldn't remember. And yeah, there was this feeling on the other side that it was all a bit of a fudge. But yeah, it's one of those things that I suppose there will always be a shadow over what is undoubtedly a great Juventus side.
Well, perhaps we'll never know the truth. Well, perhaps we already do, but we run a small media company and we're terrified of getting sued. Michael, Juventus, perhaps not the most loved team, but one of the great teams of the era?
Well, I think certainly in the period that I look at in the book, the late 90s, they are the dominant side in Italy at first and then Europe. And I think more than anything else, they certainly shaped my perceptions of what Italian football was. You know, it was tactical, it was, you know, result-based. It was about getting the job done. And yeah, as I say, it wasn't necessarily about the stars. It wasn't always about Zidane and Del Piero. Often they won the league having scored fewer goals than some of the other sides, often having won fewer games, but they always kept clean sheets. They didn't concede many goals. They didn't lose many games. And yeah, they weren't necessarily the best Italian side of the 90s because of that Milan side that came before, but I think they're probably the most Italian side of the 90s.
Well, that's it for today. Thank you so much for joining us. To remind you, Michael's book, Zonal Marking, The Making of Modern European Football, is already out. Came out at the end of May. You can get it as an ebook if you want, or an audiobook, or a hardback. It's everywhere. Right, what have we got for you next week? We got France, we got Euro 2000, and that means Julien Laurent.